You'd think that life on the other side of Easter would be just a great thing, you know, kind of paradise here on earth. After all, what could be better than actually seeing and knowing that Jesus had arisen? Because it would mean that you would arise too. That would mean death for you would also be obliterated. Nothing to fear anymore, not even death itself. Wow. But that's not what it was like. Not for the disciples, not for any of them on the other side of Easter. By all accounts, whether you're looking at Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, the resurrection was met with fear, it was met with trembling, it was met with great sadness, and it was met with doubt. Pastors will tell you that they cannot wait for Easter to end. Who can sustain that level of energy? You know, musicians get a chance to rest from all that special music that must be rehearsed and performed at near perfect pitch. Pastors have to be on because it's one Sunday when everybody packs in. We don't want to lose a crowd. About the only people who are sad that Easter, about the only people that are sad that Easter has ended are the florists. Life after Easter, you see, returns to normal, right? Just returns to normal. At least it did for the disciples. What did Peter, James, and John and the others do after the resurrection? Well, they went home. They went back to the place where it all began. It was the natural thing for them to do, going back home. Where else would you go? There were seven of them by this time, John says, which means that they were already disbanding as a group of 12. No longer a tight-knit group, they're going their own ways. These seven decide to go back to the fishing business from which they had been called in the first place. Makes sense, that's what they have done their whole lives, and that's what they know. So let's go back to what we know. The others, who knows where they went and what they did? They're not recorded in the book of Acts. But these seven return to the occupation they've known best all their lives. And it isn't that relaxed kind of fishing that you see, you know, being portrayed with a rod and reel and a little boy and a man sitting on a riverbank, something enjoyable that you might imagine. No, this was fishing that was done with big, heavy nets, and they smelled of fish scales, and they smelled of seaweed, and they hauled these nets in and out of the water and in and out of the boat over and over all day long with hands that had become completely calloused over by years and years of casting and knotting and straining against these big, heavy rope nets, day in, day out, heat, cold, you name it, doing it every day. Jesus is gone now, right? After all, at least he only is flashing up at points along the way, not staying with anybody too long. They haven't seen him in 3 weeks now, 3 weeks since Easter, not since they've left Jerusalem. And while there was a time that none of them will ever forget, that time they hadn't shared together over those 3 years, and especially that horrible Friday that we now call good, it's time to get on with life. It's time to just get back to doing what we always do. Memory is one thing, you see, but the future is another. And his life on earth may have ended, but not ours. No, we can't just live in a memory. And they have to be about getting food on a daily basis. Daily bread, just as the Lord taught them. So they go fishing, each of them sunk within their own thoughts as they climb into that old, familiar wooden boat again. One of them is reaching out to steady the bow of the boat while the others step into it and take their familiar places, swamped, I imagine, with deja vu. Back to where it all had begun. But now, it seems almost like it was some distant dream. So it's business as usual, as if nothing had really happened before it. Back to the grind, only this time, it just doesn't work. They fish all night long without catching a single fish, it says. Time after frustrating their time, they bring up their nets and put them down and bring them back empty. A perfect match, I'd say, for where their hearts are, broken and empty. And just as dawn is beginning to break, they hear this distant voice saying, "Children, have you any fish?" It's the question that the stranger who asks it already knows the answer to. And so with a tone that's kind of, I think, mixed with frustration, sadness, even anger, and even a bit of resignation, they simply reply, "No." Well, we haven't caught anything. But what a great question. Do you have any fish? Children. At first glance, it seems that the question is merely a rhetorical question, right? To move the conversation along. But if that were to translate into everyday vernacular, the question would be more like this. How are you doing today? Are you doing well today? Is it going well at what you do best? Are you satisfied with your work? Are you successful in your labors? Children, do you have anything to show for the time that you spent doing whatever it is that you're doing? Is there any progress? Notice that he doesn't ask about their discipleship, you know, how they've been doing as good disciples, making disciples and all that. He doesn't ask if they are finding spiritual comfort and moral perfection or if they're making others into followers. He asks them just a realistic question. Do you have any fish? Are you getting satisfaction out of what you're doing? What do you have to show for all your efforts? What do you have to show for all those investments on this side of Easter? And the answer is simply, nothing. Not a thing. We have worked all night and have absolutely nothing to show for our labor. Nothing to show for what we depend upon to eat and to live. It couldn't be worse than this. Because not only we, but a whole village will go hungry this morning. So the stranger says something that seems at first glance to be kind of common sense. You would think at least to the fishermen it would have been. He says, cast your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. Try the other side. Cast your net in some other area than you've been casting it in some other place. Do it differently. Try something else, something new, something better, different. Just do it differently. The world is filled, you see, I think, with folks who are good people, but they have been trapped into making a living rather than making a life. They've been taught to make a living and not necessarily how to make a life. Good people leading quiet lives, often of quiet desperation, waiting, waiting, and waiting until they can just say, I'm done, I'm done. Now I can do what I want with my life. Good people asking themselves, is this all there is to life? Is this really the abundance that I was promised? What happened to joy, man? Where is joy today to be found? What happened to my imagination and my dreams? I guess I'll just have to catch up with them later. They've gone ahead of me. And that's when the stranger comes and says to them, try the other side, guys. Try the right side this time. So they do. And the waters begin to boil and roil. With so many fish that they have fear now that their nets are going to break. They're afraid that Jesus is dead. Now they're afraid they've got too much to eat. They just live in a constant state of fear. And it's deja vu all over again, isn't it? The boats, the nets, the stranger calling them to come on out of those boats and follow him to the shore. Geez, that sounds a lot like the first call. The beloved disciple, it says, screams out, it's the Lord. And all pandemonium breaks loose. Peter, as usual, throws himself into the water, something he's become known for. And once again, he leaves all the other disciples rowing and lifting the nets by themselves so he can rush out and touch Jesus himself, be the first one. Come, he says, Jesus does, and let's have breakfast. If you've ever had breakfast on a beach, I should ask you, have you ever had breakfast on a beach? I have. How about anybody else? Anybody had breakfast on a beach? All right. You know what it's like when you're having breakfast on a sandy beach with an open fire. Copper-colored coals, that yellow flame, that orange flame glowing in the sand, heat rising in that cold morning air. You can still see your breath, but you're all huddled around that wood fire. Wood smoke's curling up through your hair. Fish sizzling on the open flames in a pan, the sound of the sea lapping up on the shore. It's just a slice of heaven, really. It's deja vu all over again. But this time, Jesus isn't serving supper. He's not serving supper this time. That was the last meal. That was the last supper of their old life together. This now is the new meal of their new life together. It's a resurrection breakfast. It's a breakfast filled with joy and wonder and awe now, prepared by the only one who knows how good life on the other side of death can be. Once again, the Lord showing us how good life is, showing us how good it is to sit together and be together. I don't know why I have so many of the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus have something to do with food. Maybe it's because secretly they were all Presbyterian and they just didn't know it. Or maybe it's because eating is just that essential to life, right? Most of us eat 3 meals a day. Most of us share that meal with somebody else. And so it's necessary to life to eat together. It's part of what gives us that daily sustenance. In any case, it's one of the clues about his presence in the Gospels, this breakfast that they're having. Because there's always the chance that when you're eating together, when you're talking with each other, when you're really being vulnerable with each other, that you'll discover something about the Lord in your midst. You'll discover something about the nature of God from somebody else who reveals you that incarnating face that says, ah, this is the Lord's presence again here. And the story is full of clues for those times that we're marooned on a sea of doubt or a sea of fear in the middle of the night, afraid that we have come to the end of something that we have no idea how we're going to pick up and put the pieces back together and begin all over again. So I would say it's when those times happen, especially when those times happen, that it's probably a good idea to pay attention to strangers, especially those who seem to know things about you or that things that you might need even though you were not expressing it to anybody, and they just seem to know. Whether they're giving you unsolicited advice, you might want to call your parents. You might want to call your daughters about where to cast our nets, about walking with us and opening hope back up for you. It's probably a good idea then to pay attention to those strangers, since Jesus has a tendency to keep appearing in disguises after the resurrection. He appears on a road to Emmaus. He appears at a beach fry. He appears in an upper room walking through doors. He allows people to touch him, but it's never the same person. It's a different person. And there's another clue that we might hang on to as we wait for the Lord's return, because he's returning to us all the time, for those at least who have eyes to see it. It's a sudden change, maybe, in the way life is going for you. And I'm not talking about rags to riches. I hear that prosperity gospel preached all the time. If you have enough faith, if you believe hard enough by God, God wants you to be rich. No, it never says that in the Bible. It just doesn't. But I'm talking about that kind of sudden change in your life, the way your life now looks to you, where it didn't look so good before, when you suddenly look at your life and you go, wow, I thought it was hopeless, and the next moment I see possibilities open up before me that I never envisioned. One moment the net is empty, and the next it is full. It is overflowing with fullness. It is the Lord's doing. That's what the beloved disciple said. It's the Lord. That's the only explanation that makes sense. How did he know it? How did he know it? How does anybody know it's Jesus, really? By staying, I guess, on the lookout, right? By watching, by listening, by being open and feeling, being vulnerable, by living with that expectation and refusing to believe that the last word is that the nets are empty and that's it, that's all there is to it. That our nights will last forever and ever, and there will be no dawn, there will be no new light, there will not be a tomorrow, which is the lie. For those, Jesus says, who have ears to hear and eyes to see, let them hear. There's a voice, you see, out there crying in the wilderness that can turn all of our dead ends into new beginnings. Come on, the voice says. A new day's dawning. Let's eat. What more is there, say, folks? Maybe. Thank you. Thank you. Let us break bread and drink wine together on this day that we celebrate breakfast and the resurrection to new life. Amen.